He was Tom's best friend. What will you do? I'll talk to Margaret tonight and see what she knows, I said. After that, my only option is to go back to Santa Teresa and confer with the sheriff's department there. And tell them what? You don't have much. I don't have anything, I said. Unless something develops, I'm at a dead loss.
I see. Then I suppose that's it.
Selma stubbed out her cigarette and got up without another word. She began to clear the dinner dishes, moving from the table to the sink. Let me help you with that, I said, getting up to assist.
Don't trouble.
Her tone of voice was frosty, her manner withdrawn. I began to gather up plates and silverware, moving to the sink where she was already scraping leftover jello into the garbage disposal. She ran water across a plate, opened the door to the dishwasher, and placed it in the lower rack. The silence was uncomfortable, and the clattering of plates contained a note of agitation.
"Is something on your mind?" I asked. "I hope I didn't make a mistake in hiring you."
I glanced at her sharply. "I never offered you a guarantee. No responsible PI could make a promise like that. Sometimes the information simply isn't there," I said.
"That's not what I meant."
"Then what were you referring to?"
"I never even asked you for references."
A little late at this point. "You want to talk to some of my past employers? I'll make up a list." She was silent again. I was having trouble tracking the change in her demeanor. Maybe she thought I was giving up.
"I'm not saying I'll quit," I said. "I understand. You're saying you're out of your league."
"You want to go up against the cops? Personally, I've got more sense." She banged a plate down so hard it broke down the middle into two equal pieces.
"My husband died."
"I know that. I'm sorry."
"No, you're not. Nobody gives a shit what I've gone through."
"Selma, you hired me to do this, and I'm doing it. Yes, I'm out of my league. So is Tom, for that matter. Look what happened to him. It fucking broke his heart." She stood at the sink, letting the hot water run while her shoulders shook. Tears coursed along her cheeks. I stood there for a moment, wondering what to do. It seemed clear she'd go on weeping until I acted sincerely moved. I patted her awkwardly, making little murmurings. I pictured Tom doing much the same thing in his life, probably in this very spot. Water gurgled down the drain while the tears poured down her face. Finally, I couldn't stand it. I reached over and turned off the water. "Live through enough droughts, you hate to see the waste." Where originally her grief had seemed genuine, I now suspected the emotion was being hauled out for effect. At long last, with much blowing and peeking at her nose products, she pulled herself together. We finished up the dishes, and Selma retreated to her room, emerging shortly afterward in her nightie and robe, intending to make herself a glass of hot milk and get in bed. I fled the house as soon as it was decently possible. Nothing like being around a self-appointed invalid to make you feel hard-hearted. Margaret and Hatch lived close to the center of town on 2nd Street. I'd called from Selma's before I left the house. I'd scarcely identified myself when she cut in, saying,
"Dolores said you came to see her. What's this about?"
In light of her father's murder, the answer seemed obvious. "I'm trying to figure out what happened to your father," I said. "I wondered if it'd be possible to talk to you tonight. Is this a bad time for you?" She'd seemed nonplussed at my request, conceding with reluctance. I couldn't understand her attitude, but I wrote it off to my imagination. After all, the subject had to be upsetting, especially in light of his past abusiveness. Twice she put a palm across the mouthpiece and conferred with someone in the background. My assumption was that it was Hatch, but she made no specific reference to him. The drive over was uneventful, despite the treacherous roads and the continuous sleet. There was no accumulation of snow so far, but the pavement was glistening, and my tires tended to sing every time I hit a slippery patch. I had to use the brakes judiciously, pumping gently from half a block back when I saw the stoplights ahead of me change. Paranoid as I was at that point, I did note the close proximity of the Brine's house to the parking lot at Tiny's Tavern where I'd been accosted. Once Wayne and Erlene dropped the Brines off at home, Hatch could easily have doubled back. I found myself scouring the streets for sight of a black panel truck, but of course saw nothing.
I entered a tract of brick ranch houses, maybe 15 years old, judging from the maturity of the landscaping. Tree trunks were now sturdy, maybe 8 inches in diameter, and the foundation plantings had long ago crept over the window sills. I slowed when I spotted the house number. The Brines had 2 cars and a pickup truck parked in or near the drive. I found a parking spot 2 doors down and sat at the curb wondering if there was a party in progress. I turned in my seat and studied the house. There were dim lights in front, brighter lights around the side and toward the portion of the rear that I could see from my vantage point. This was Saturday night. She hadn't mentioned a Tupperware party or Bible study, nor had she suggested I come at some other time. Maybe they were having friends in to watch a little network television. I debated with myself. I didn't like the idea of walking into a social gathering, especially since I could always talk to her tomorrow. On the other hand, she'd said I could come, and meeting with her tonight would delay my return to Selma's. I still had a key to her place, and the plan was for me to let myself in the front door whenever I got back that night. The car became noticeably colder the longer I sat. The neighborhood was quiet, with little traffic and no one visible on foot. Someone peeking out the windows would think I'd come to case the joint. I got out of the car and locked the doors. The sidewalks must have been warmer than the streets. Snowflakes melted instantly, leaving shallow pools in lieu of icy patches. The trees in the yard were some deciduous variety, caught by surprise with tiny green buds in sight. March in this area must have been a constant series of nature pranks. I knocked on the door, hoping I wasn't walking in on a naughty lingerie party. Maybe that's why she'd invited me, in hopes I'd purchase a drawer full of underpants to replace all my tatty ones. Margaret opened the door wearing blue jeans and a thick red sweater with a Nordic design across the front. Snowflakes and reindeer. She wore clunky, calf-high suede boots with a sheepskin lining that must have felt warm on a night like this. With her black hair and oval glasses, she looked like a teenager hired to babysit. "Hi, come on in." "Thanks. I hope I'm not interrupting. I saw cars in the drive." "Hatch's poker night. The boys are in the den," she said, hooking a thumb toward the rear. "I'm on kitchen detail. We can talk out there." Like Selma's house, this one smelled as if it had been sealed for the winter, the rubber gaskets on the storm windows ensuring the accumulation of smoke and cooking smells. The wall-to-wall carpet was a burnt orange high-low. The walls in the living room painted a shade of café au lait. The 8-foot sofa was a chocolate brown with 2 black canvas butterfly chairs arranged on either side of the coffee table. "You didn't have any trouble finding the place?" she asked. "Not at all," I said. "You prefer Margaret or Maine? I know Dolores refers to you as Maine."
"Either one is fine. Suit yourself."
I followed her to the kitchen at the end of the hall. She was in the process of preparing food, platters of cold cuts on the long wood grain formica counter. There were bowls of chips, 2 containers of some kind of dip made with sour cream, and a mixture of nuts and Czech cereals tossed with butter and garlic powder. I know this because all the ingredients were still in plain view. "If you'll help me move these snacks to the dining room, we can get 'em out of the way and we can talk." "Sure thing." She picked up 2 bowls and shoved the swinging door open with a hip, holding it for me while I moved through with the tray of sliced cheeses and processed meats. Of course, it was all so unwholesome I was immediately hungry, but my appetite didn't last long. Through an archway to my left, I saw Hatch and his 5 buddies sitting on metal folding chairs at the poker table in the den. There were countless beer bottles and beer mugs in evidence, cigarettes, ashtrays, poker chips, dollar bills, coins, bowls of peanuts. To a man, the entire gathering turned to look at me. I recognized Wayne, James Tennyson, and Brandt. The other 2 fellows I'd never seen before. Hatch made a comment and James laughed. Brandt raised his hand in greeting. Margaret paid little attention to the lot of them, but the chill from the room was unmistakable. I placed bowls on the table and moved back to the kitchen, trying to behave as though unaffected by their presence. Here's the truth about my life. Just about any jeopardy I encounter in adulthood, I experienced first in elementary school. Guys making private jokes have struck me as sinister since I was forced to pass the 6th grade boys every morning on my way to kindergarten.
Even then, I knew no good could come of such assemblages, and I avoid them where possible. I picked up a platter from the kitchen counter and intercepted Margaret as she reached the swinging door.
"Why don't I pass these to you, and you can put them on the table?" I said, feigning helpfulness.
In truth, I couldn't bear subjecting myself to that collective stare.
She took the platter without comment, holding the door open with her hip.
"You might want to open a couple more beers. There's some on the bottom shelf of the refrigerator out on the utility porch."
I found 6 bottles of beer and the beer flip and made myself useful removing caps.
Once we'd assembled the eats, Margaret pulled the swinging door shut and sighed with relief.
"Lucky they don't play more than once a month," she said.
"I told Hatch they should rotate, but he likes to have 'em here. Usually Earlene tags along with Wayne and helps me set up, but she's coming down with a cold, and I told her to stay home."
Shit.
"Excuse my language. I forgot to put out the paper plates. I'll be right back."
She snatched up a giant package of flimsy paper plates and moved toward the dining room.
"You want anything to eat, you can help yourself," she said.
As I was still burping meatloaf, I thought it wise to decline.
She came back to the kitchen and tossed the cellophane packaging in the trash, then turned and leaned against the counter, crossing her arms in front.
"What can I help you with?"
The question suggested cooperation, but her manner was all business.
"I'm just wondering what you can tell me about his last visit. I'm assuming he and Alfie Toth came to the area to see you that spring."
"That's right," she said. As though to distract herself, she began to screw lids on the pickle jars, stowing mustard and mayonnaise back in the refrigerator.
"I hope you don't think this is disrespectful, but my father was a loser, and we all knew that. Truthfully, I was happiest when he was in jail. He always seemed to cause trouble."
"Was he a problem on this visit?"
"Of course. Mostly chasing women. Like any woman here was that hard up," she said.
"From what little I know, I never pictured him as a ladies' man."
"He wasn't, but he'd just gotten out of jail and he was itching to get laid.
He'd be at Tiny's at 4 the minute the doors opened. Once he started drinking, he'd hit on anyone who crossed his path. He thought he was irresistible, and he'd be angry and combative when his ham-handed flirtations didn't net him what he wanted."
"Anybody in particular?"
Margaret shrugged.
"A waitress at the Rainbow and one at Tiny's. Alice, the one with the red hair."
"I know her," I said.
"That's all he talked about. How horny he was. Poontang, he called it." I was embarrassed. I mean, what kind of talk is that coming from your dad? He couldn't have been more obnoxious. He got in fights, he borrowed money, he dinged the truck. People around here won't tolerate behavior like that. It drove Hatch insane, so of course the two of us were fighting. Hatch wanted them out of here, and I can't say I blamed him. What are you going to do, though, your own dad? I could hardly ask him to leave. He'd been here less than a week."
"So what finally happened?"
"We sent him and Alfie off on a fishing trip. Anything to get them out from underfoot for a couple of days. Hatch lent him a couple of fishing rods he never did get back. He was PO'd about that. Anyway, I don't know what happened, but something must have gone wrong. Next morning, Alfie showed up and said they decided to take off and he'd come for their things."
"Where was your father?"
"Alfie told us Daddy was waiting for him, and he had to get a move on or Pinky'd be furious with him. I didn't think anything about it. I mean, it did sound like him. He was always trying to get Alfie to fetch and carry for him."
"Did Tom know all this?"
"I told him in March when Daddy's remains turned up. Once the body was identified, Tom notified me, and I passed the news on to the rest of the family. Before that, as far as I knew, Dad was fine."
"Didn't it strike you as odd that no one in the family ever heard from him once he supposedly left here?"
"Why should it? Bad news travels fast. We always figured if something happened to him, someone would be in touch. Police or a hospital. He always carried ID. Besides, we heard from Alfie now and then. I guess the two of them split up, or that's the impression he gave."
"Why did he call?"
Margaret shrugged. "Beats me. Just to see how we were doing is what he said."
"Did he ever ask about your dad?"
"Well, yes, but it wasn't like he really wanted to get in touch. You know how it is. How's your dad? What do you hear from him? And that sort of thing."
"So he was wondering if Pinky ever showed up again. Is that it?"
"I guess. Finally, he stopped calling, and we lost touch with him."
Maybe he realized Pinky wasn't ever going to put in an appearance.
That's what Tom said. He thought Daddy might have been murdered the very day Alfie left, though there was never any way to prove it. One thing they found was a gas receipt he'd tucked in his pocket. That was dated the day before. Him and Alfie filled up the tank on their way to the lake.
You think Alfie knew something?
Almost certainly, I said.
Maybe the two of them quarreled.
It's always possible, I said. Judging from his behavior, he was either trying to create the impression that Pinky was alive, or he really wasn't sure himself.
The last time you saw him, when he stopped by to pick up their belongings, did he seem okay to you?
Like what? He wasn't nervous or in a hurry?
He was in a hurry for sure, but no more than he'd be with Daddy waiting.
Any signs he'd been in a scuffle?
Nothing that I noticed. There wasn't any dirt or scratches.
How did they plan to travel? Bus, train, plane, hitchhiking?
They must have gone by bus. I mean, that was my assumption because the truck was left over at the Greyhound station.
Hatch spotted it in the parking lot later that same day, she said.
Chapter 19. By the time I left Margaret's, it was close to 9:30. I unlocked the VW and slid under the wheel, sticking the key in the ignition. A car approached, and as it pulled up alongside, I could see that it was Macon, driving a black and white. Even through the car window, I could tell he was better dressed for the cold than I was. I was wearing my brown leather bomber jacket, but was short the gloves, scarf, and cap. I rolled down my window. His car idled, static from the radio filling the air. The temperature had dropped. I blew on my fingers briefly and then turned the key in the ignition, firing up the VW just to get the engine warm. I adjusted the heat, which in a VW consists of moving one lever from off to on.
"What's up?" I asked.
"I'm on tonight anyway, so I thought I might as well follow you home. I talked to Selma a little while ago, and she told me what was going on. I'm glad you came back. She was worried you'd abandon ship."
"Believe me, I was tempted. I'd rather be at home," I said.
"I remember this Pinky Ritter business. Ornery son of a gun. Was Margaret any help?"
"About what you'd expect," I said, evading the issue. "I'm heading over to Tiny's. She says he hustled one of the waitresses, so I'll see what she says. It might not mean anything, but I could pick up additional information. Maybe a jealous husband or a boyfriend was dealing out paybacks. You have any other suggestions?"
"Not offhand. You seem to be doing pretty good,"
Macon said, but he didn't sound convinced.
"Why don't you let me ask around and see what I can find out? Seems like the fewer people who know what you're after, the better."
"My sentiments exactly. Anyway, I better get a move on before I freeze." Macon glanced at his watch.
"How long will this take?"
"Not that long. 30 minutes at best. I'm not even sure Alice works Saturdays. I'm assuming she does."
"Why don't I follow you as far as the parking lot? I can swing back at 10 and follow you to Selma's. If the woman isn't working, have a Coke or something until I show up."
"I'd appreciate that. Thanks." I rolled up the window and put the car in gear. Macon pulled out first, waiting for me to do a U-turn so I could follow him. With the boys entrenched in their poker game inside, I was feeling safer than I had all day. The parking lot at Tiny's was packed with cars, RVs and pickup trucks with camper shells. I tucked the VW into a small gap at the end of the last row. Macon waited, watching me cross two aisles, passing through the shadowy spaces between vehicles. Once I was at the rear entrance, I turned and waved to him, and he took off with a little toot of his horn. I checked my watch. 10:05. I had until 10:30, which should give me plenty of time. Saturday night at Tiny's was a rowdy affair. Two alternating live bands, line dancing, contests, whooping, hollering, and much thumping of cowboy boots on the wooden dance floor. There were six waitresses working in a steady progression from the bar to the crowded tables. I spotted Alice with her gaudy orange hair half a room away, and I pushed my way through the jostling three-deep bystanders ringing the room. I had to yell to make myself heard. She got the message and pointed toward the ladies' room. I watched her deliver a sloshing pitcher of beer and six tequila shooters, then collect a fistful of bills that she folded and pushed down the front of her shirt. She angled in my direction, taking orders as she came. The two of us burst into the empty ladies' room and pushed the door shut.
The quiet was remarkable, the noise in the tavern reduced by more than half.
"Sorry to drag you away," I said. "Are you kidding? I'm thrilled. This is hell on earth. It's like this most weekends, and the tips are shit."
She opened the first stall door and stepped just inside. She took a pack of cigarettes out of her apron pocket.
"Keep an eye out for me, would you? I'm not supposed to stop for a smoke, but I can't help myself."
She shook a cigarette free and fired it up in no time. She inhaled deeply with a moan of pleasure and relief.
"Lord, that's good. What are you doing here? I thought you went home to wherever it is."
"I left. Now I'm back."
"That was quick."
"Yeah, well, I know a lot more now than I did 2 days ago."
"That's good. More power to you. I hear you're investigating a murder. Margaret Brine's father, or that's the word."
"It's slightly more complicated, but that's about it. As a matter of fact, I was just at her place, asking about his last visit." Alice snorted.
"What a horse's ass he was. He hustled my butt off, the randy little shit. I pinned his ears back, but he was hard to shake."
"Who else did he hustle? Anyone in particular? Margaret tells me he was horny as all get out." Alice held up a hand. "Mind if I interrupt for a sec? Something I should mention before you go on."
I hesitated, alerted by something in her tone.
"Sure."
Alice studied the tip of her lighted cigarette. "I don't know how to say this, but people around here seem to be concerned about you."
"Why? What did I do?"
"That's what everybody's asking. Grapevine has it you're into drugs."
"I am not. How ridiculous. That's ludicrous," I said.
"Also, you shot a couple of fellows in cold blood a while back."
"I did?" I said, laughing in startlement. "Where'd you hear that?"
"You never killed anyone?"
I felt my smile start to fade.
"Well, yes, but that was self-defense. Both were killers coming after me," Alice cut in.
"Look, I didn't get the details, and I don't really give a shit. I'm willing to believe you, but folks around here take a dim view of it. We don't like the idea of somebody coming in here starting trouble. We take care of our own."
"Alice, I promise, I've never shot anyone without provocation. The idea's repugnant, I swear."
"Where did this come from?"
"Who knows? This is something I picked up earlier. I overheard the fellows talking."
"This was tonight?"
"And yesterday some, too. This was shortly after you left. I guess someone did some digging and came up with the facts."
"Facts?"
"Yeah, one guy you killed was hiding in a garbage can."
"That's bullshit. He wasn't hiding, I was."
"Well, maybe that's what I heard. You were lying in wait, which somebody pointed out was pretty cowardly. Word is, the most recent incident was 3 years back. It was in the Santa Teresa papers. Someone saw a copy of the article."
"I don't believe this. What article?"
Alice drew on her cigarette, regarding me with skepticism. "You weren't involved in a shootout in some lawyer's office?"
"The guy was trying to kill me. I just told you that. Talk to the cops if you don't want to take my word for it."
"Don't get so defensive. I'm telling you for your own good. I might have done the same thing if I'd been in your place, but this is redneck country. Folks here close ranks. You better watch your step, is all I'm saying."
"Somebody's trying to discredit me. That's what this is about," I said hotly.
"Hey, it's not up to me. I don't give a damn. You can whack anyone you want. There's times I'd do it myself, given half a chance," she said. "The point is, people are getting pissed. I thought I should warn you before it went too far."
"I appreciate that. I wish you could tell me where it's coming from."
Alice shrugged. "That's the way it is in small towns. If you remember where the story originated, will you let me know?"
"Sure thing.
In the meantime, I'd avoid crossing paths with the cops if I were you."
I felt a pang of anxiety, like an icicle puncturing my chest wall.
"What makes you say that?" "Tom was a cop. They're mad as hell."
Alice dropped the lighted cigarette in the toilet with a spat, and then she flushed the butt away, waving at the air as if she could clear the smoke with a swishing hand.
"You want anything else?"
I shook my head, not trusting myself to speak.
I waited at the side exit, my hands in my pockets, though the chill I felt was internally generated. I kept my mind on other things, defending against a mounting surge of uneasiness. Maybe this was why Macon was suddenly being so protective. The night sky was overcast, and where the air should have been crystalline, a ground fog began to drift across the darkened parking lot. Two couples left together. One of the women was blind drunk, laughing boisterously as she staggered across the icy tarmac.
Her date had his arm across her shoulders, and she leaned against him for support. She stopped in her tracks, held her hand up like a traffic cop, and then turned away to be sick. The other woman leaped backward, shrieking in protest. The ill woman lingered, holding on to a parked car till she was done and could move on. The foursome reached their vehicle and piled in, though the sick woman sat sideways with her head hanging out the door for a good 5 minutes before they were finally able to pull away. I searched the empty rows of cars, checking the dark. The music from the bar behind me was reduced to a series of dull, repetitive thumps. I caught a flash of light and saw a car pull in. I stepped back into the shadows until I was assured it was Macon in his black and white. He pulled up beside me and sat there with his engine running. I moved forward, walking around the front of the patrol car to the window on the driver's side. He rolled it down as I approached.
"How'd it go?" he asked.
I could hear the ratchet of his car radio, dispatcher talking to someone else. He turned the volume down. I put a hand on the door.
"Alice tells me there's a rumor going around that I'm some sort of dope-crazed vigilante."
He looked off to one side. He stirred restlessly, tapping the steering wheel with his gloved hand.
"Don't worry about gossip. Everybody talks in this town."
"Then you heard it, too?"
"Nobody pays any attention to that stuff."
"Not true. Someone went to the trouble to do a background check."
"And got what? It's all bullshit. I don't believe a word of it."
Which meant he'd heard the same stories everyone else had been treated to.
"I better see you home. I got a call to check out."
I got in my car and he followed me as far as Selma's driveway, his engine idling while I crossed the front lawn. Selma had left the porch light on and my key turned easily in the lock. I waved from the doorway and he took off. I slipped out of my wet shoes and carried them down the hall to the guest room. The house was quiet, not even the murmur of a television set to suggest Selma was awake. I slipped into the guest room and closed the door behind me. She'd turned on a bed-table lamp, and the room was washed in cheery pink. On the nightstand, she'd left me a plate of homemade chocolate chip cookies secured in plastic wrap. I ate two, savoring the flavors of butter and vanilla. I ate two more to be polite before I stripped off my jacket. Apparently, Selma was not in the habit of turning down the furnace at night, and the room felt close with heat. I crossed to the window, pushed the curtains aside, and raised the sash. Frigid air poured through the gap left by the storm window, still resting against the bushes 3 feet down. I stared out at the portion of the street that I could see. A car passed at a slow speed, and I pulled back out of sight, wondering if the occupants had spotted me. I hated being in Nota Lake. I hated being an outsider, the target of local gossip that misrepresented my actions. I hated my suspicions. The thought of a uniform was beginning to make me salivate like a dog subjected to some odd form of Pavlovian conditioning. Where once the badge and the nightstick had been symbols of personal safety, I now found myself picturing them with trepidation, as if stung by electric shocks. If I was right about the guy's connection to law enforcement, then his was the badge of authority. And what was I? Some little pipsqueak P.I. with a prissy sense of justice. Talk about a mismatch. Why couldn't I just hop in my car and barrel home tonight? I needed to be in a place where people cared for me. For a moment the pull was overpowering. If I left within the hour, I could be in Santa Teresa by 4 a.m. I pictured my snug platform bed with its blue and white quilt, stars visible through the plexiglass dome overhead. Surely the sky there would be clear and the air would smell like the Pacific thundering close by. I visualized the morning. Henry would bake cinnamon rolls and we'd have breakfast together. Later I could help him in the yard where he'd kneel at his flower beds, the pale soles of his feet like something cast in plaster of Paris. I stepped away from the window, effectively breaking the spell. The only road home is through the forest, I thought. Within minutes, I'd peeled off my clothes and pulled on the oversized T-shirt I was using as a gown. Usually I sleep nude, but in someone else's house, it pays to be prepared in case of fire. I washed my face and brushed my teeth with the usual difficulty. I returned to the bedroom and circled restlessly. The bookshelves were filled with knick-knacks. There was not so much as a magazine in view, and I'd forgotten to bring a book this time. I was too wired for sleep. I took the file from the duffel and got into bed, adjusting the reading lamp so I could review the notes I'd typed. The only item that leapt out at me was James Tennyson's report of the woman walking down the road the night Tom died. According to his account, she was approaching from the direction of Tom's truck, and she veered off into the woods when she caught sight of his patrol car. Was he lying about that? Had he invented the woman in an attempt to throw me off? He hadn't struck me as devious, but the touch would have been nice since it suggested Tom had been in the woman's company when he was stricken with his fatal heart attack. I wondered what kind of woman would have walked off and left him in the throes of death. Perhaps someone who couldn't afford to be seen with him. Knowing what I knew of him, I didn't believe he was having an affair, so if the woman existed, why conceal her presence? I knew he'd been at the Rainbow Cafe at some unaccustomed hour. What was interesting was that James had told me about this alleged female as an addendum to his original comments. I tend to be suspicious of elaborations. Eyewitness reports are notoriously unreliable. The story changes each time it's told, modified for every passing audience, amplified, embellished, until the final version is a twisted variation of the truth. Certainly, the memory is capable of playing tricks. Images can be camouflaged by emotion, popping into view later when the mental film is rewound. Conversely, people sometimes swear to have seen things that were never there at all. For the second time, I wondered if Tom had gone to the Rainbow Cafe to meet someone. I'd asked Nancy about it once, but it might be time to press. I set my notes aside and doused the lights. The mattress was soft and seemed to list to one side. The sheets had a satin finish that felt slick to the touch and generated little traction to offset my tendency to slide. The quilted spread was puffy, filled with down. I lay there and basted in my own body heat. In testimony to my constitution, I fell asleep at once. I woke to the distant sound of the phone ringing in the kitchen. I thought the answering machine would pick up, but on the eighth persistent ding-a-ling, I flung off the covers and trotted down the hall in my T-shirt and underpants. There was no sign of Selma, and the machine had been turned off. I lifted the receiver. "Newquist's residence." Someone breathed in my ear and then hung up. I replaced the receiver and stood there for a moment. Often, someone calling a wrong number will dial the same number twice, convinced the error is yours for not being who they wanted. The silence extended. I reactivated the answering machine and then checked Selma's appointment calendar posted on the refrigerator door. There was nothing marked, but this was Sunday, and I remembered her mentioning a visit to a cousin down in Big Pine after church. The dish rack was empty. I opened the dishwasher. I could see that she'd eaten breakfast, rinsed her plate and coffee cup, and left them in the machine, which was otherwise empty. The interior walls of dishwasher exuded a residual heat, and I assumed she'd done a load of dishes first thing this morning before she'd left. The coffee machine was on. The glass carafe held 4 cups of coffee that smelled as if it had sat too long. I poured myself a mug, adding sufficient milk to offset the scorched flavor. I padded back to the guest room where I brushed my teeth, showered, and dressed, sipping coffee while I girded my loins. I didn't look forward to another day in this town, but there was nothing for it except to get the job done. Like a dutiful guest, I made my bed, ate the remaining 3 cookies to fortify myself, and returned the empty coffee mug and plate to the kitchen, where I tucked both in the dishwasher, following Selma's good example. I grabbed my leather jacket and my shoulder bag, locked the house behind me, and went out to the car. Phyllis was pulling into her driveway 2 doors down. I waved, convinced she'd spotted me, but she kept her eyes averted, and I was left feeling foolish with the smile on my lips. I got in the car, forcing myself to focus on the job at hand. The gas gauge was close to E, and since I was heading toward the Rainbow, I stopped for gas on my way out of town. I pulled up to the full-serve pump and turned the engine off, reaching into my bag to find my wallet and gasoline credit card. I glanced over at the office windows where I could see 2 attendants in coveralls chatting together by the cash register. Both turned to look at my VW and then resumed their conversation. There were no other cars at the pumps. I waited, but neither came forward to assist me. I turned on the engine and gave the car horn a sharp toot. I waited 2 minutes more. No action at all. This was annoying. I had places to go and didn't want to sit here all day waiting for a lousy tank of gas. I opened the car door and stepped out, peering across the top of the car to the open bay. The two attendants were no longer visible. Irritated, I slammed the car door and moved toward the office, which had been deserted. Hello? Nothing. Could I get some service out here? No one. I went back to the car, where I waited another minute. Maybe the two lads had inexplicably quit work, or had been devoured by extraterrestrials hiding in the gents. I started the engine and honked sharply, a display of impatience that netted nothing in the way of help. Finally, I pulled out with a little chirp of my tires to demonstrate my agitation. I slid into the flow of traffic on the main street and drove 6 blocks before I spotted another station. Ha ha ha, thought I, so much for the competition. I had no credit card for this rival brand, but I could afford to pay cash. Filling a VW never amounts to that much. I pulled into the second station, doing much as I had before. I turned the engine off, checked my wallet for cash. There was a car at the adjacent pump, and the attendant was in the process of removing the nozzle from the tank. He glanced at me briefly, and then I saw the alteration in his gaze. I said, "Hi, how are you?" He took the other woman's credit card and disappeared into the office, returning moments later with her receipt on a tray. She signed and took her copy. The two chatted for a moment, and then she pulled out. The attendant went back to the office, and that was the last I saw of him. What was going on? I checked myself with care, wondering if I'd been rendered invisible in my sleep. I stared at the office window and then checked for another service station within range. I could see an off-brand station 3 doors down. Even with my gauge showing empty, I knew my trusty VW could soldier on for many miles yet, given the mileage I got. Still, I was reluctant to squander the last of a tank of gas looking for a place to buy the next tank of gas. I started my engine, put the car in gear, drove out of that gas station and into the one 200 yards away. This time I saw an attendant in the service bay, and I pulled in there first. Let's get this out in the open, whatever it was. I leaned over and rolled down the window on the passenger side. Pleasantly, I said, "Hi, are you open for business?" His blank stare sparked a moment of uneasiness. What was wrong with him? I tried a smile that didn't feel right, but was the best I could manage. "Do you speak English?" "Habla inglés?" or something to that effect. His return smile was slow and malevolent. "Yeah, lady, I do. Now why don't you get the fuck out of here? You want service in this town, you're out of luck." "Sorry," I said. I shifted my gaze, keeping my expression neutral as I drove out of the station and turned right at the first street. Under my jacket, the sweat was soaking through the back of my shirt. Chapter 20. Once out of sight, I pulled over and parked on a side street to assess my situation. The word had clearly gone out, but I wasn't sure whether these guys were queuing off my car or my personal description. I removed my leather bomber jacket and tossed it in the back seat, then rooted through the assorted garments I kept for just such emergencies. I donned a plain red sweatshirt, a pair of sunglasses, and a Dodgers baseball cap. I got out, opened the trunk, and took out the 5-gallon gasoline can I keep in there. I locked the car and hiked over to the main street, where I headed for a service station I hadn't tried so far. I bypassed the office and went straight to the service bay, where a cursing mechanic was struggling to loosen a stubborn lug nut on a flat tire. I checked the sign posted by the door that said, "Mechanic on Duty," with the guy's name, Ed Boone, on a plastic plaque inserted in the slot. I moved out of the bay and sidled up to the office, where I poked my head in the door. The attendant was maybe 19, with a bleach-blonde crew cut and green-painted fingernails, his attentions focused on the glossy pages of a pornographic magazine. "Uncle Eddie told me I could fill this. My pickup ran out of gas about a block from here. This is mine, by the way," I said, holding up the can. I didn't want the fellow claiming later that I'd stolen it. Given my current reputation as a stone-cold killer, the theft of a gasoline can would have been right in character. I fancied I saw a flicker of uncertainty cross his face, but I went about my business like I owned the place. I walked to the self-serve pump, giving him a sidelong glance to see if he was on the telephone. He stared through the plate glass window, watching me without expression as I filled the container. The total was $7.45. I returned to the office and handed him a 10, which he tucked in his pocket without offering change. His gaze dropped to his magazine again as I walked off. Nice to know that regardless of how low you sink, someone's always willing to make a profit at your expense. I return to my car, where I empty the 5 gallons of gasoline into my tank. I return the can to the trunk and took off with the gauge now sitting at the halfway mark. My heart was beating as though I'd run a race, and perhaps I had. Apparently, my actions would be observed and curtailed wherever possible from here on. Never had I felt quite so alienated from my surroundings. I was already on unfamiliar turf, and in subtle and not-so-subtle ways, I depended on the ordinary day-to-day pleasantries for my sense of well-being. Now I was being shunned, and the process was scaring the shit out of me. Scouring the moving traffic, I realized my pale blue VW was highly visible among all the pickups, campers, utility vehicles, horse vans, and 4x4s. 6 miles out of town, I pulled into the gravel apron of the Rainbow Cafe. Angling around to the left, where I backed into a parking spot on the far side of the big garbage bins. I sat for a moment, trying to get centered, as Californians say. I've no idea what the term means, but in my present circumstance, it seemed applicable. If I was being banished from the tribe, I'd better make sure I had a grip on myself before I went any further. I took a couple of deep breaths and got out. The morning was overcast, the mountains looming in the distance like an accumulation of thunderclouds. Down here, where large tracts of land stretched out empty and desolate, the wind whistled along the surface, chilling everything in its path. Snow flurries like dust motes hung in the icy air. Crossing the gravel parking area, I felt extraordinarily conspicuous. I glanced at the cafe windows and could have sworn I saw 2 customers stare at me and then avert their eyes. A chill went through me, all the ancient power of ostracism by the clan. I imagined church services in progress, the Catholics and the Baptists and the Lutherans all singing hymns and giving thanks, attentive to their respective sermons. Afterward, the Nota Lake devout would crowd into the local restaurants, still dressed in their Sunday best and eager for lunch. I said a little prayer of my own as I pushed through the door. The cafe was sparsely occupied. I did a quick visual sweep. James Tennyson was sitting at the counter with a cup of coffee. He wore jeans, the newspaper open in front of him. Close at hand were an empty water glass and a crumpled blue and black Alka-Seltzer packet. There was no sign of his wife, Jo, or his baby, whose name escaped me. Rafer's daughter, Barrett, with her back to me, was working the grill. She wore a big white apron over jeans and a T-shirt. A white chef's toque concealed her springy, flyaway hair. Deftly she wielded her spatula, rolling sausage links, flipping a quartet of pancakes. While I watched, she moved the steaming food to a pair of waiting plates. Nancy picked up the order and delivered it to the couple sitting by the window. Rafer and Vicky Lamotte sat in the booth midway down the line of empty tables. They'd finished eating, and I could see that Vicky was in the process of collecting her handbag and overcoat. James looked baggy-eyed and drawn. He caught sight of me and nodded, his manner a perfect blend of good manners and restraint. His fair-skinned good looks were only slightly marred by what I imagined was a hangover. I headed for a booth in the far corner, murmuring a greeting to Rafer and Vicky as I breezed by. I was afraid to wait for a response lest they cut me dead. I sat down and positioned myself so I could keep an eye on the door. Nancy caught my attention. She seemed distracted, but not unfriendly, crossing toward the counter to pick up a side of oatmeal. "I'll be with you in just a minute. You want coffee?" "I'd love some." Apparently she wasn't a party to the social boycott. Alice the night before had been friendly as well, at least to the point of warning me about the freeze coming up. Maybe it was just the guys who were shutting me out. Not a comforting thought. It was a man, after all, who dislocated my fingers only 3 days earlier. I found myself rubbing the joints, noticing for the first time that the swelling and the bruises gave them the appearance of exotic, barely ripe bananas. I turned my crockery mug upright in anticipation of the coffee, noting that the fingers still refused to bend properly. It felt like the skin had stiffened, preventing flexion. While I waited for service, I studied James in profile, wondering about his contact with Pinky Ritter and Alfie Toth. As a CHP officer, he would have been removed from any sheriff's department action. But he might have exploited his friendships with the deputies to glean information about the homicide investigation. He was certainly first at the scene the night Tom died, giving him the perfect opportunity to lift Tom's notes. I was still toying with the possibility that he invented the walking woman, though his motive remained opaque. It wasn't Colleen. She'd assured me she'd never visited the area, a claim I tended to believe. Tom had too much to lose if he were seen with her. Besides, if she'd been in the truck, she wouldn't have deserted him. The Lamotts emerged from their booth, hunching into overcoats in preparation for their departure. Vicky crossed to the counter to chat with Barrett, while Rafer moved to the register and paid the check. As usual, Nancy did double duty, setting her coffee pot aside to take his 20 and make change. James rose at the same time, leaving his money on the counter beside his plate. He and Rafer exchanged a few words, and I saw Rafer glance my way. James pulled on his jacket and left the restaurant without a backward look. Vicky joined her husband, who must have told her to go out and wait for him in the car. She nodded and then busied herself with her gloves and knit cap. I wasn't sure if she was ignoring me or not. Once she was gone, Rafer ambled in my direction, his hands in his coat pockets, a red cashmere scarf wrapped around his neck. The coat was beautifully cut, a dark chocolate brown setting off the color of his skin. The man did dress well. "Hello, Detective Lamotte," I said. "Rafer," he corrected. "How's the hand?" "Still attached to my arm." I held my fingers up, wiggling them as though the gesture didn't hurt. "Mind if I sit down?" I indicated the place across from me, and he slid into the booth. He seemed ill at ease, but his expression was sympathetic, and his hazel eyes showed disquiet, not the coldness or hostility I'd half expected. "I had a long talk with some Santa Teresa fellows about you." I felt my heart start to thump. "Really? Who?" "Coroner, couple cops, homicide detective named Jonah Robb," he said. He put one elbow on the table, tapping with his index finger while he stared out across the room. "Ah, tracking down the stories going around about me." His gaze slid back to mine. "That's right. I might as well tell you from the perspective of the sheriff's department, you're okay. But I've heard rumbles I don't like, and I'm concerned." "I'm not all that comfortable myself, but I don't see any way around it. Responding to rumors only makes you look guilty and defensive. I know because I tried it and got nowhere." He stirred restlessly. He turned in the seat until he was facing me squarely, his hands laced in front of him. His voice dropped a notch. "Listen, I know about your suspicions. Why don't you tell me what you have, and I'll do what I can to help?" I said, "Great," wondering why I didn't sound more sincere and enthusiastic. I thought about it briefly, experiencing a frisson of uneasiness. "I'll tell you what concerns me at the moment. A plainclothes detective, or someone posing as one, showed up at a Fleabag hotel in Santa Teresa with a warrant for Toth's arrest. The Santa Teresa Sheriff's Department has no record of an outstanding warrant anywhere in the system, so the paper was probably bogus. But I don't have a way to check that because I don't have access to the computer."
"I can run that," he said smoothly. "What else?"
I found myself choosing my words with care.
"I think the guy was a phony, too. He might have been a cop, but I think he misrepresented himself."
"What name did he give?"
"I asked about that, but the clerk I talked to wasn't on the desk that day, and he claims the other fellow didn't get a name."
"You think it was someone in our department?"
he said, making it a statement, not a question.
"Possibly." "Based on what?"
"Well, doesn't the timing seem a bit coincidental?"
"How so?"
"Tom wanted to talk to Toth in connection with Pinky Ritter's death. The other guy got there first, and that was the end of poor old Alfie. Tom was a basket case starting in mid-January when Toth's body turned up, right?"
"That's Selma's claim."
Rafe's manner was now guarded, and he started tapping, the tip of his index finger drumming a rapid series of beats. Maybe he was sending me a message in Morse code.
"So isn't it possible this is what Tom was brooding about? I mean, what else could it be?"
"Tom was a consummate professional for 35 years. He was the investigating officer in a homicide matter that I would say, yes, captured his interest. But no, did not in any way cause him to lie awake at night and bite his nails. Of course he thought about his work, but it didn't cause his heart attack. The idea's absurd."
"If he was under a great deal of stress, couldn't that have been a contributing factor?" Why would Toth's death cause him any stress at all? This was his job. He never even met the man, as far as I know. He felt responsible.
For what?
Toth's murder. Tom believed someone gained access to his notebook where he'd jotted down Toth's temporary address and the phone number at the Gramercy.
How do you know what Tom believed?
Because that's what he confided to another sheriff's investigator.
Colleen Sellers.
That's right.
And Tom told her this?
Well, not explicitly, but that's how the killer could have found Toth and murdered him, I said.
You still haven't said why you suspect someone from our department.
I'll broaden the claim. Let's say someone in law enforcement.
You're fishing.
Who else had access to his notes?
Everyone, he said. His wife, his son Brant. Half the time the house was unlocked. Add his cleaning lady, the yard man, his next-door neighbor, the guy across the street. None of them are involved in law enforcement, but any one of them could have opened his front door and walked right in. And what makes you so sure it wasn't someone in Santa Teresa? The leak didn't necessarily come from this end.
I stared at him. You're right, I said.
He had a point.
The tapping stopped, and his manner softened.
Why don't you back off and let us handle this?
Handle what?
We haven't been entirely idle. We're developing a lead.
I'm glad to hear that. About bloody time. I hate to think I'm the only one out here with my ass on the line.
Cut the sarcasm and don't push. Not your job.
Are you saying you have a line on Alfie's killer?
I'm saying you'd be smart to go home and let us take it from here.
What about Selma?
She knows better than to interfere with an official investigation. So do you.
I tried Selma's line.
There's no law against asking questions. That depends on who you ask.
He glanced at his watch.
I got Vic in the car, and we're late for church, he said.
He got up and adjusted his coat, taking his leather gloves from one pocket. I watched him smooth them into place and thought inexplicably of his early morning arrival at the emergency room, freshly showered and shaven, nattily dressed, wide awake. He looked down at me.
Did anyone ever fill you in on local history?
Cecilia did. He went on talking as if I hadn't spoken.
Bunch of convicts were shipped to the colonies from England. These were hardened criminals, literally branded for the heinousness of their behavior.
The Nota of Nota Lake, I supplied dutifully.
That's right. The worst of them came west and settled in these mountains. What you're dealing with now are their descendants. You want to watch your step.
I laughed uneasily. What, is this like a western? I'm being warned off? Like I have to be out of town by sundown?
Not a warning, a suggestion. For your own good, he said.
I watched him leave the restaurant and realized how dry my mouth had become. I had that feeling I used to get before the first day of school, a low-level dread that acted as an appetite suppressant. Breakfast didn't sound like such a hot idea. The place had cleared out. The couple by the window was getting up to leave. I saw them pay their check, Barrett taking over the cash register while Nancy hurried in my direction with a coffee pot and menu, all apologies. She handed me the menu. Sorry it took me so long, but I was brewing a new pot and I could see you and Rafer had your heads together, she said. She filled my mug with hot coffee. You have any idea what you want to eat? I don't mean to rush you. Take your time. I just don't want to hold you up. You've been so patient.
I'm not hungry, I said. Why don't I move to the counter so we can talk?
Sure thing. I picked up my mug and reached for the silverware. I'll get that, she said. She took the menu and the flatware, moving to the counter where she set a place for me between the griddle and the cash register. Barrett was in the process of cleaning the grill with a flat-edged spatula. Bacon fat and brown particles of pancake and sausage were being pushed into the well. Nancy rinsed a rag and twisted out the excess water, wiping the counter clean. Alice says you've been asking about Pinky Ritter.
You remember him? Every woman in Nota Lake remembers him, she said tartly.
Did he ever bother you? Meaning what, unwanted sexual advances? He attacked me one night when I got off work. He waited in the parking lot and grabbed me by the neck as I was getting in my car. I kicked his ass up between his shoulder blades, and that was the last of that. He was convicted of rape twice, and that's just the times he was caught.
Did you report it?
What for? I took care of myself. What's the law going to do? Come along afterwards and smack his hand?
Barrett had now come over to the small sink just below the counter in front of us, and she was in the process of rinsing plates and arranging them in the rack for the industrial dishwasher I assumed was in the rear. She had her father's light eyes, and she made no secret of the fact that she was listening to Nancy's tale and enjoying her attitude. I caught her attention.
"Did he ever come on to you?"
"Uh-uh. No way," she said, a blush creeping up her cheeks. "I was close to jailbait at that point, barely 18 years old. He knew better than to mess with me."
I turned to Nancy. "What about other women? Anyone in particular? Earlene or Phyllis?"
Nancy shook her head. "Not that I heard, but that doesn't mean he didn't try. Guy like that goes after anyone who seems weak."
"Could I ask you about something else?"
"Sure. The night Tom Newquist died, he was in here earlier, wasn't he?"
"That's right. He came in about 9 o'clock, ordered a cheeseburger and fries, sat around and smoked cigarettes like he was killing time. Occasionally, he'd look at his watch. I couldn't figure it out. He never came in up at that hour. I figured he was meeting someone, but she never showed up."
"Why do you say she? Couldn't it have been a man?"
Nancy seemed surprised at the idea.
"I never thought about that. I just assumed."
"Did he mention anyone by name?"
"No."
"Did he use the telephone?"
She shook her head with some uncertainty and then turned to Barrett with a quizzical look.
"You remember if Tom Newquist used the phone that night?"
"Not that I saw."
Again I directed a question to Barrett. "Did you get the impression he was here to meet someone?"
Barrett shrugged.
"I guess."
Nancy spoke up again.
"You know what I think it was? He was freshly shaved. I remember remarking about his cologne or his aftershave. He looked sharp, like he'd gussied himself up. He wouldn't do that if he were here to meet some guy."
"You agree with that?" I asked Barrett.
"He did look nice, now you mention it," she said. "I noticed that myself."
"Did he seem annoyed or upset, like he'd been stood up?"
"Not a bit of it," Nancy said. 9:30, got up, paid his check, and went out to his truck. I never saw him afterwards. I did closing that night, so I was stuck in here. Did you see him out there?"
"In the parking lot? Not me."
"You must have. You took off shortly before he did."
Barrett thought about it, frowning slightly before she shook her head.
"Maybe he was parked around back."
"Where were you parked that night?" I asked.
"Nowhere. I didn't have a car. My dad was picking me up."
"She just lives over there on the other side of that subdivision, but her folks don't like her walking home at night. They're real protective, especially her dad."
Barrett smiled, her dark skin underlined with the pink of her embarrassment. "I could be a preacher's daughter. That'd be worse."
We chatted on for a while. The place began to fill with the after-church crowd, and I was clearly in the way. I was also hoping to avoid further confrontation with any irate citizens. I hunched into my jacket and went out to the car. Since the parking spot I'd found was around the rear, I didn't think I was visible to passing vehicles. I didn't have the nerve to drive into town just yet. I couldn't bear the idea of wandering around on my own, risking rudeness and rejection on the basis of floating rumors. People in the cafe had been fine, so maybe it was just the service station attendants who'd passed a vote of no confidence. I saw Macon Newquist pull off the highway and into the parking lot in a pickup truck. He was dressed in a suit that looked as unnatural on him as a bunny costume. I knew if he saw me, he'd start pumping me for information. I torqued myself around, reaching for my briefcase as though otherwise occupied. Along with my case notes, I tucked in the packets of index cards. I waited until he disappeared into the cafe before I got out of the car and locked it. I took my briefcase with me as I crunched along the berm to the Noda Lake cabins. Out front, the red vacancy sign was lighted. The office lobby was unlocked, and there was a flat plastic clock face hanging on the doorknob, with the hands pointing to 11:30. The sign said, "Back in a jiffy." I went in, crossing to the half-door that opened onto the empty office. "Cecilia, are you here?" There was no answer. I was tempted, as usual, by the sight of all those seductive-looking desk drawers. The Rolodex and the file cabinets fairly begged to be searched, but I couldn't for the life of me think what purpose it would serve. I sat down in the upholstered chair and opened a pack of index cards.
I began to read through my notes, transferring one piece of information to each card with a borrowed ballpoint pen. In some ways, this was busy work. I could feel productive and efficient while sheltered from public scrutiny. Transcribing my notes had the further advantage of diverting my attention from the state of discomfort in which I found myself.